All right, well, if you've got your Bibles, we're going to 2 Samuel, so I got 2 weeks to work on this sermon. I said it was very strange, so who knows, I may go an hour and a half, so I just double it up since I had 2 weeks to work on it. So no, I don't think I'll do that, but we're going to pick up right where we left off, the beginning of 2 Samuel. You might remember 2 weeks ago when we finished up the first chapter, Saul and Jonathan had both died in battle. They had been defeated by the Philistines. It was a kind of crisis moment that had broken out, but for David, it was a kind of opportunity, an opportunity to finally grab the throne that he had been promised so long ago. But in chapter 1, what we saw was David pause. Instead of reaching out and taking the throne in this opportunity, he instead decides to pause and lament, to remember even his enemy Saul and also his friend Jonathan. We saw it so clearly how unique David's position was by the contrast of this opportunistic Amalekite, who comes to David with the crown, the armband, assuming that he'll be richly rewarded for having finished off Saul. And instead, David sees through and recognizes him working the angles, attempting to manipulate the opportunity for his own good, and ultimately taking his hand against God's anointed. Last week was a warning against attempts to use opportunities, headlines, and situations that break into our life, viewing everything that happens in the world around us as opportunities for our own benefit. A breaking news story doesn't free us from this call to follow, to patiently watch and see what God is doing, to seek out God's direction, and to attempt not to take the first step, but always the second step behind where God is leading. You're going to see a little bit more of it this week as we continue the story. Really, all the way through about chapter 5, we find ourselves in this context, this crisis of who will be the next king, and how will they come to power, who will seize control of this leadership vacuum that Saul has left by his death. This time, the desperation is going to come much closer to David than an Amalekite who wanders into the camp with a message. This time, the conflict will begin to break out in David's own family, in David's own camp, amongst Israel itself. Let's go ahead and jump in. I'm going to read all of chapter 2, and then we'll work back through the story. So 2 Samuel chapter 2, we'll read through the entire chapter, verse 1. So right where we left off, chapter 1, the lament, chapter 2 begins. After this, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." David said, "To which shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. When they told David it was the men of Jabesh Gilead who buried Saul, David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed by the Lord because you showed this loyalty to Saul, your Lord, and buried him. Now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead, and the Asherites, and Jezreel, and Ephraim, and Benjamin, and all Israel. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel. And he reigned 2 years. I skipped too far, give me a second. And the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zariah, the servant of David, went out to meet them at a pool of Gibeon. Don't worry, we'll work back through all of these characters. There's lots of names and locations this week. They meet at this pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, the one on the one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." Then they arose and passed over by number 12 from Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword into his opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore that place was called Helkath Hazarim, which is at Gibeon. And the battle was very fierce that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of Saul. And the three sons of Zariah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. And Asahel was as swift of foot as a wild gazelle. And Asahel pursued Abner, And as he went, he turned neither to his right hand nor to his left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is it you, Asahel?" And he answered, "It is I." Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left and seize one of the young men and take his spoil." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said it again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" But he refused to turn aside. Therefore Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, so that the spear came out of his back. And he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. And as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gia, on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner and became one group and took their stand on the top of the hill. Then Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that this end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers?" And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up their pursuit of their brothers until the morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all of the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight any more. And Abner and his men went all that night through the Arab. They crossed the Jordan and marched the whole morning. They came to Mahanaim. Joab returned from his pursuit of Abner, and he had gathered all the people together that were missing from David's servants, 19 men besides Asahel. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin 360 of Abner's men. And they took up Asahel and buried him in the tomb of his father, which was at Bethlehem. And Joab and his men marched all night, and the day broke upon them at Hebron. That's a crazy story. One that I'm sure you found yourself. You've had 2 weeks to read through it since we missed, and I'm sure most of you sat last night reading through the chapter, and you closed your Bibles, and you said, "You know what, honey? After reading 2 Samuel chapter 2, there's some big changes I now want to make in my life. I'm turning over a new leaf because of this chapter." I'm sure that's how the conversation went. None of us are competing for crowns. None of us find ourselves in this context of battle breaking out, but I think it'll surprise you a little bit. I realize how strange this chapter is. It'll surprise you how universal this story, I think, actually is. What it has to say about desire and this experience being closer at hand than you might realize the first time you read that passage. I want to work back through the story and try to make a little sense. I realize there's a lot going on, and then draw out a couple of conclusions. To get the story right, you have to put it back in the context of what was happening in the politics, the setting of ancient Israel in this time. Prior to writing the books of Samuel, you might remember in the book of Judges, there was no king. There was really no united government in all of Israel. All of Israel in the book of Judges is portrayed as more loyal to their own tribes. I was from the tribe of Benjamin. I was from the tribe of Judah. Everybody belonged to their tribe, and that was their ultimate loyalty. The only time those tribes really joined together was when there was unity required to defend against some kind of common enemy. You might remember that Saul really came to power and united the tribes of Israel because of the threat, the pressure from the Philistines. It was the Philistines pressuring in that caused all of these tribes to set aside their individual loyalties and finally form what was a united Israel under a single king. But with Saul dead, what pretty quickly happens is everyone reverts back to their separate tribal loyalties. Everybody starts wondering what that now means for them, for their tribe, for their people within Israel. Chapter 2 opens with David, his request, his prayer to God about returning back home. You might remember David has been spending time in the distant far reaches of Philistine territory, hiding out from Saul. Notice again, David doesn't go riding into the power vacuum, seizing this opportunity for his own angle, but instead he goes to God in prayer and asks, "Is now the time that I should finally return to Judah?" Judah is David's own people. It's his home. It's his tribe that he belongs to. And Judah at this time was the largest of the 12 tribes, and sure enough, God responds to David's request positively. "It's time to go home, David. Back to your own people. Back to Judah." David packs up his men, packs up their families, and he heads back home to Judah. And pretty quick, not too long after arriving there, the independent Judah decides to crown him king, if nothing else, of Judah. He may not be the king of all of Israel at this point, but his own people have decided it's enough to have him back home to call him their king. He becomes the king of Judah. But there's a big problem in the middle of the story. Saul has died. Jonathan, the apparent heir to the throne, has died. But there's still powerful people from Saul's administration living, active, and not quite willing to give up all of the power just because Saul has been killed in battle. Chief among them is this character we meet, who we've actually met before, but he's been in the background, a battle-hardened general named Abner. Abner had been around the block. He had been around in Israeli politics for a long time. Saul had been his cousin. He had watched Saul come to power and unite Israel. He was there when Saul was crowned king. He was there for years, leading Saul's military conquests, the chief military advisor and commander of Saul's army. He was most likely there the day that David had come forth and defeated Goliath. He was there probably on the outskirts the day that Jonathan and Saul had been killed. All of this time, he gets portrayed with one defining characteristic. He's a hardened military man, but also a politically shrewd man. This is a man who's seen enough of life, enough of power, enough of politics to know how to work the angles to keep himself at the top. And Abner wasn't ready to fall from power just because his cousin Saul had lost the throne. With the news of Saul's death, Abner quickly acts. He declares Saul's remaining son, Ishbosheth, the new king of Israel, and begins to unite a new kingdom under his power. Given Abner's political connections, this long history being at the center of politics, he's able to do it pretty efficiently. The other 11 tribes, besides Judah, all rally behind Ishbosheth, although really they're probably rallying behind the influence that Abner has, a kind of kingmaker. This division of Israel into these two peoples, the 11 tribes, often referred to as Israel, and Judah in the south, its own kingdom, is one that becomes important and plays out on later in Scripture. We don't know a lot about this new king, Ishbosheth, which is a little bit surprising considering he's one of the sons of Saul, like Jonathan had been. He was a son, but we find out he's 40 years old when he takes the throne. This is not a small child, but a grown man. It's a little bit strange because we know almost nothing about one of Saul's full-grown sons, especially compared to how much we had known about Jonathan, Jonathan's reputation and skills, and the hope that Jonathan would become king. Ishbosheth, although he's mentioned several times, never actually speaks in this story. He gets thrust into the throne, thrust by Abner to the top as king, but the image that's portrayed of Ishbosheth is a kind of puppet of Abner, used in the moment by a man with more political ideas than he might have had on his own, a kind of pawn in the hands of Abner. No real ambition, but Abner's ambition, Abner's desire for power that props him up in a politically expedient way. Ishbosheth ends up looking kind of clueless to everything that's going on. You'll see that even more in the chapters to come. On David's side, we actually find a similar power broker as well, an equal to Abner. David had a man at the head of his military named Joab. Joab is depicted as equally determined to Abner. But while Abner is shrewd, politically sensitive, Joab appears aggressive and determined, ready to fight at a drop of a hat, ready to usher in David to the throne by grit and determination and power and might. Joab is also family. He's David's nephew. Joab is actually the son of David's sister. And he had been serving for similarly long times in David's own military as a commander through all of the wilderness years. Like Abner, Joab can feel the significance of this moment. He knows that this is a time that requires action. He's passionate, singularly focused on the rise of David to the throne. Wrapped up in that ambition is a kind of self-righteousness, a belief that this is God's destiny, and he's been appointed for times like these to usher in David, the rightful king. These two men form the sort of center point of this story, chapter 2. Abner on one side, his agenda, Joab on the other, equally with an agenda. Both men, Abner and Joab, sense the significance of this moment, the times that they find themselves in. They must have imagined that it's times like these that call for men like them, men of action, destiny, an opportunity that needs to be seized, competed, and taken. Between these two men hangs a crown. Between them is an opportunity, a moment. Between them is a cause that they find themselves believing in, caught up in, defined by. And between them is an assumption that the only thing that lies between them and that power, them and that goal, is the other. What stands before Joab is Abner, and what stands before Abner is Joab. And it just so happens that these two men find themselves, with their finest warriors alongside them, on opposite sides of the same pool, the same lake at Gibeon. It's not quite right to instantly think that what's happening here is the two men have gathered their soldiers to attack each other. I mean, after all, they're both Israelites. They see themselves as brothers, belonging to the same tradition, the same people. They may both want the crown, but neither one has openly declared war on the other. How could they, given it was their own brothers? It was civil war. How could they against the people that they worshipped with and believed with and identified with? But they find themselves facing each other, opposite sides of this pool, and there's a palpable and obvious tension between these two men that, as readers, it's pretty hard not to pick up on. They stand facing one another, and they realize they want the same thing. They seem cordial, even friendly, but we know, really, they're after more. It reminds me of a certain political event. Some of you will probably remember it. Since 1945, there's this annual tradition in New York City. It's a dinner called the Al Smith Dinner. Some of you have maybe seen it. For sure, during presidential elections, you see clips. You would remember those clips. Since 1960, it's the tradition of presidential candidates to both appear at this fundraiser. It's always very awkward because they sit near each other, they laugh at each other's jokes, they give speeches roasting each other. The whole thing is supposed to be a fun, lighthearted event. People love it because as you watch, it's incredibly awkward, and you can see the tension of them attempting to laugh at each other's jokes. Here are these two people who every other night of the entire year pretty obviously despise each other and can't stand to be around each other. But for this one night, they sit down at similar tables and they laugh at each other's jokes and even give half-hearted compliments to the other candidate. But it's pretty easy. Everyone knows what's really going on. They may laugh at the jokes, but make no mistake, what they're really trying to do is capture a headline the next morning to get the perfect joke in that's really a shot at their opponent. The laughs and the occasional compliments are usually pretty fake. We all know what's going on, which is part of what makes it fun to watch. Even the humor can't hide the intensity of the competition that we know is really going on behind the scenes, behind the jokes, behind the smiles, the laughs, the hors d'oeuvres. I think it's a pretty good image of what's going on at that pool. These two men act cordial. They're both Israelites, after all. They're both God's people, leaders in God's people. But beneath the surface, as they look at each other, they're sizing one another up. They're comparing. Those comparisons are leading to calculations, angling, thinking about how the other could be beaten and what's to gain from it. The shrewd Abner proposes a competition, just the thing he imagines might let some of this steam off. Plus, whoever wins will inevitably walk away feeling quite proud, a morale boost for the men that they lead, and probably confidence that God must be on their side. Look at the victory they just had. Abner isn't looking to start a war by this recommendation. He's only looking to gain a little more influence, a little more leverage, some propaganda to take back home, a little more power out of it, a leg up on the competition, a little humiliation for his opponent. The way that it gets translated as a contest is probably the idea of some sort of a wrestling match. The word has the idea of sport or entertainment. Let the men come before us and have a competition, a sport. They can entertain us by this. Literally, the King James Version translates it, let the men arise and play before us, which catches a little bit of the idea. This isn't instantly some sort of a gladiator fight to the death for someone to receive the crown. What's happening here is a kind of friendly competition, a sport. It's the same root that Isaac, you might remember the character from Genesis, his name comes from, the trickster who made a sport of life and took advantage. It's the same word here, this competition, this friendly competition. The whole thing is like an arm wrestling match, which the other imagines they can now walk away with bragging rights from. But it's not hard again to see that there's more on the line than just bragging rights. Some of you, some of these men who are here, they understand that much more is going on. Much more is at stake. And what happens next is pretty obviously ridiculous in the story. It's so over the top that the first time you read this story, if you were just honest about it, it's kind of a little bit of shock and hard to understand what's going on. You read it closely and you pick up that this chapter sounds nothing like the chapters that have come before it in Samuel. Remember, the chapter before is full of poetic lament, right? And David going to God with questions and prayer. And you read this passage and you say, I'm not quite sure what to make of it, but this doesn't sound like the passages that have come before. One commentator calls it vaudeville slapstick comedy. It's so over the top, so ridiculous. The story isn't funny, but what happens is no doubt ridiculous for a reason. It's trying to make a characterization, to shock us into seeing a significant point. 12 men are selected from each tribe, each of the groups, to go out and compete. And almost immediately, the game, the sport, the arm wrestling turns bloody. They grab one another by the head and instantly thrust their swords into one another's side, and all 24 of them fall dead. Not a single competitor left alive. which is surprising because if there was supposed to be some bragging rights that comes out of this competition, who's left bragging when all 24 of them die in the conflict? Nothing ends up decided. There's no single winner. Everyone loses in this sport that they're playing. They're again at a standstill, just like they were before this competition. But this time, blood has been spilt. They've exposed what both sides are really after. Both are just as desperate to one-up the other and get control. Both want far more than they're at first openly willing to admit. And God seems to, in a dramatically ironic way, suggest that he's not willing to play for either side. When they fight each other, no one wins. No one comes out ahead. But by this point, as men too often are, blood in their eyes, thirst for more vengeance, the point is past, no one stops to consider what God might be meaning from it. It's all gone too far now, and the whole day breaks out in a full-scale war between the two groups of men. 380 of them are killed in the action. Abner and his men begin to suffer the greatest amount of loss and retreat, but it still isn't over. Israel, under David, his men, Joab, begin to pursue. Joab, David's man, was one of three sons, and this will become important. We're introduced to them here, but in the chapters to come, we'll see it come up again. Joab was one of the sons of Zerah. Of the three sons, Asahel was apparently the fastest, and he recognizes an opportunity. He sees Abner running, Saul's man, and he recognizes that he could catch up to him, defeat him. It might be just the thing they need. So he takes out after him with gazelle-like speed. What follows again is very strange. It struck me this week as a little bit of a kind of Three Stooges scene, if you ever watched the Three Stooges. As they're running for their lives, as fast as they can, Abner keeps turning over his shoulder to carry on a conversation with his pursuer. Remember, Joab, his brothers are driven by this kind of idealistic passion. David's the rightful king, but remember, Abner is willing to cut a deal that's politically motivated for the moment. He's opportunistic. He's willing to negotiate even as he runs for his life. And twice, Abner turns to try to reason with the pursuing Asahel. Abner argues, "If you force me to kill you, I'll never be able to have peace with your brother, because your brother will always want revenge, and this is just going to continue, more death, more fighting, more blood." But Asahel will not relent. He won't be persuaded. We're told that Abner struck him with the end of his spear, and it pierced all the way through Asahel. It's as if Asahel, blinded by his passion from all reason and sight, ran right into the end of Joab's spear. His momentum was so great, he ran right through his target, skewered by the very goal that he was pursuing after. And again, what happens? The whole thing just ratchets up a whole nother set of tension, because now Joab, his brother, has even more to fight for, the revenge of his own brother's death. Joab is now not only determined that David should be king, but that his brother's life should be avenged, that Abner should be struck down for the death that he had caused. Abner and his troops take their final stand, their final last defense on a hill. And as Joab approaches, Abner makes one last negotiation plea. Then Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their own brothers?" And Joab seems to take the advice. Just like that, he and his men call off the attack and return home. But don't be too fooled. The conflict is just paused for the moment. Because as Joab leaves, what's in his heart is still conflict, still competition, still the threat, the obstacle of Abner. Strange story. The real striking question at the end of chapter 2 is this. Where in the world is David when all of this is going on? Isn't this book supposed to be about David coming to power? David was at the center of the last chapter, but he's absolutely nowhere to be seen in chapter 2, outside of the introduction of him moving back home and blessing the men who had buried his enemy Saul. The last time David was portrayed, that was the image, honoring the men who had buried his enemy, praying to God about returning home. These men may claim to be for David in the story, but it's not hard to see that they don't seem very David-like. The way that they go after trying to prop David into this new position of king doesn't seem like the role David has been taking for himself. So what do you do with it all? What do you make of this story? I actually think this will hit a little closer home than you might first suspect. The theme that comes out of this passage is the tendency of desire, even good desires, opportunities, things that we want. The tendency of those desires to produce competitors, and that competition to produce violence. A few months ago, I came across a French Catholic philosopher named Rene Girard. This is what happens when you give me 2 weeks to work on a sermon, by the way. I start quoting from French Catholic philosophers, so bear with me. He developed this theory called the mimetic theory of desire. His idea was that the things we most desire in life, the things that we really want, that we're pursuing, they're not just internal impulses that come out of us. That was what the ancient philosophers believed. The desire was just this uncontrollable thing that sprung out of your life and you were forced to contend with. Girard instead describes it by saying that we learn to desire the things that we want by seeing the desire of other people around us. Mimetic, that's what he called it, mimetic desire, which is just a fancy philosophical word for imitation. We learn desire by imitating the desires of others. You might not instantly think that's true, that everything you want in life is somehow shaped by seeing what someone else wants, but I think I can show it to you. Think for a second about the things you most want in life. I've talked before about wanting 40 acres of land with an old farmhouse and good turkey hunting. That's one of my goals. You might want a certain car. You might want certain vacations. You might want certain clothes or careers. You might have a certain image of you or your family, on and on and on. We could go down the list of things that are most important to you, real desires, goals in your life. How do you think those desires would change if you had grown up on a deserted island and had never seen a billboard, never seen a commercial, never walked past a rack of magazine covers at the grocery store, sat and talked over coffee with friends describing their own goals, their own desires, their recent purchases? If you had never heard or seen what anyone else was pursuing, how do you think it would impact the things that seem most valuable to you? How do you think those desires would change if there was no one around you who had what you were trying to get? No one you saw pursuing the same desires to compare yourself to track your progress with. If no one else wanted it, do you think it would change how desperately you want it? Why do you think it is that companies spend millions and millions and millions of dollars getting celebrities to endorse products? Take, for instance, Michael Jordan, which Nike spent millions and millions of dollars to hold up pairs of shoes and put his name on, Air Jordans. Calling them an Air Jordan doesn't tell you absolutely anything about the durability or the support of the shoe, but it does something more important to most of us. It suggests that people you might admire, like Michael Jordan, wear these shoes. And you could wear shoes like the ones that he's holding up. Most of us are smart enough to realize that by putting on Michael Jordan's shoes, you don't suddenly get better at basketball or able to dunk a basketball. But if that image is important to you, if appearing a certain way or feeling a certain way, like Jordan, athletic, capable, if those are important, then maybe owning those shoes, having those shoes, is just enough to feel a bit closer, a little closer to the goal. We could probably go on. Maybe Jordan's basketball shoes is not your angle. Maybe it's TV designers who push shiplap constantly, or a friend who's two steps ahead of you at all times, has what you want. Be honest enough to admit there's people that begin to shape the desires around you. People you see, celebrities that hold up products, maybe not as obviously as celebrity endorsements, but sure enough, their life, their goals, their desires, their passions begin to shape, begin to change what you want. That plays itself out in all kinds of desires. You see something someone else has, and all of a sudden you find yourself wanting it too. Look at what it's done for them. Look at the joy they find out of it. Look at what their life looks like with that possession. If only I could have it, maybe I might share the same thing. You begin to want what they have. Your desires, mimetic, imitative, are being shaped by the people around you far more than you probably realize or admit to yourself. It's surprising to see how desperate Abner and Joab both are for power in this story. I mean, after all, Abner, this cousin of Saul, had just watched what happened to Saul, how he had lost his crown in a humiliating defeat because of disobedience to God. And Joab had supported David through all of the wilderness years of obscurity, where David had been taught time and time again to patiently trust God. Both men had pretty good examples of why attention to what God was doing was far more important than their own desires. But with the crown hung between the two of them, the competition forming between the two of them, they couldn't help but finding themselves desiring it even more. Had either of the two men paused, if they had thought for even 2 seconds about what God was doing, God had given them plenty of opportunities to see through the self-justifications and recognize the reckless, the destructive desire that was forcing both of them into this moment of conflict. But their passion was stoked not just by the opportunity, but by the risk that the other might seize the moment, might seize the power before them. This is an important point. The other wanted it. The other was working for it. The other was angling and trying to make it happen, to get the crown, to get the power. And seeing the desire of the other stroked in him a greater desire himself. That is, the conflict, the competition, produced even greater desire, ratcheted the desire up into a blinding effect that forced the two men hurtling towards the same goal, neither with any discernment for what God might be doing. They were blinded not just by passion or desire, but by the threat of another, a competitor, who might beat them to it. Their real fear was not that they might lose the throne, not possess the throne. Their real fear was that the other might get to it first, might have it instead of them. C.S. Lewis has this great line in his chapter, Mere Christianity, one of his most famous chapters on pride, where he explains that pride never cares how much that it accumulates. Pride never cares how much you have of any given thing, only that you have a little bit more of it than the next person. That is, pride is always comparison. One of my favorite ways of putting it, there's an American essayist who describes wealth this way. Wealth is defined as an income that is at least $100 more a year than the income of your wife's sister's husband. You catch the comparison. Wealth is always in comparison to someone else around you. Pride, always taking its stance by the game of comparing to what someone else has, wanting just a little bit more of it. You might as well admit that a big part of what you want has to do with what you see people around you getting. A big part of what you want and what you desire has been shaped by the way that you compare and evaluate the people around you and their pursuits. This is what's so important to see about this conflict breaking out in Israel. Desire has a tendency to feed off of comparison, to feed off of a competitor, and that desire to begin to grow into a violent and reckless kind of competition that singularly focuses our eyes, our emotions, and our energy on one comparison, one pursuit. We end up evaluating everything in our own lives by the comparison with another. In that comparison, competition begins to form. Our desire begins to intensify because the thing that we compare with another has become our marker of success, the victory. Competition, passing by the other and feeling like we finally moved to the front of the pack. Back to Girard for a second. This was his point as well about mimetic desire. Eventually, the very person who inspired that passion in you, who set the goal for you by comparison, who created your desire, eventually that person becomes your competitor for the very desire that they created in you. Here are these two men staring across the pool at each other, and what is forming between them is competition, inspiration. They even admit it, though they cloak it in sport, friendly competition. They can't hide what they're really feeling and really wanting for too long. The competition turns bloody. The real motives instantly become clear. That's a terrifying thought if you're willing to be really honest with yourself. Subtle competitiveness that you feel towards another person, that you may not even be willing to admit towards another person, might run much deeper than you've ever realized before. You're not going to like hearing this next point, but the two men, as we see in the story, look almost identical. They come from different camps. They have slightly different motives, agendas, different approaches. But for us, it's obvious that they're characterizations of one another, set on this kind of equal balance between this similar desired goal. But could you imagine suggesting to one of the other men that they were just like the other? Could you imagine saying to Joab, you know, you remind me a lot of Abner, or saying to Abner, you remind me a lot of Joab? They would have been passionate about how different they were, offended by any comparison that would put them in the same camp as this rival, this competitor. But that's an interesting and uncomfortable thing to admit. Often the people who drive you most crazy, the people that you're most desperate to be distinguished from, might be the people that you're actually most like. You can draw out all kinds of distinctions. You can force yourself to talk about how much different you are and why you're different in so many ways, but from the outside, for those who recognize the two of you competing for the same thing, it's pretty obvious that you're both playing the same game, on the same field, the same competitors, really a characterization of the same desire. Girard writes this, an interesting quote, "Only someone who prevents you from satisfying a desire, which he himself has inspired in you, is truly an object of hatred. The person who hates first hates himself for the secret admiration concealed by his hatred. And in an effort to hide this desperate admiration from others and from himself, he no longer wants to see in his mediator anything but an obstacle. The person that inspired the desire eventually becomes an obstacle, a goal to be overcome in the competition. Gerard warns that what we hide, this true violent competition, often gets hidden from even ourselves. The subtle comparisons that we imagine being so strikingly different actually reveal how much we desperately want the same things. It's what's so striking about this passage to me in 2 Samuel 2. Everyone is smiling and laughing. They propose a game, a flag football, to see who's the better group of men. It'll be fun, a friendly competition, nothing but bragging rights on the line, they say to one another, probably even kind of believing it about themselves. But the very moment they hit the field, the very moment they're given the opportunity, the swords come out and the friendly smile, the handshake, turns to blood. It masks a real heart of murder, a real heart of hatred. Unchecked desire, desire that we're unwilling to be honest about, has a tendency to lead us into kinds of comparison that produce competition that frequently turns violent. Surprisingly, it turns violent most easily against its own brother, against the very person it spends the most time with, playing this friendly competition. And so we're given stories in the Bible like Cain, who kills his own brother out of secret competition that turned to hatred and eventually spilled over into violence. But maybe even if you don't find yourself hiding a sword when you go to competition, Jesus reminds us that to hate your brother in your heart, even a hidden hatred by comparison, is already to have committed murder, to wish for his very death. This is one of the remarkable things about David's story that's beginning to develop in this vacuum of David's rise to leadership. David refuses to look at people as competitors. David refuses to join this field of competition. Even people who are competing against him, people who are angling to take from him what he imagines is divinely his, he just simply won't play the game that everyone else says that he needs to. He won't work the angles, he won't make the comparison. David just keeps forfeiting the competition, trusting that God is doing something bigger than it is required of him to take the field to produce. He won't compete with Saul. You might remember when Saul found himself with his back turned to David in the cave, David felt guilty for removing even a portion of his hem. David won't take his sword out and run it into the side of Saul. He won't compete. He won't compare. He won't compete for Saul's crown and his death. He won't wage war against Saul's own son. David asks permission to go back to his own home. He blesses a town that's under Ishbosheth's control for having honored his enemy, Saul. None of it looks like competition. You'll see more and more as David does, in fact, rise to the throne and become king. He will do it in such a way that won't require him to climb over people, to use people, to manipulate others, to compete and win at others' expense for this crown. When David looks at the men and the women around him, he sees souls. He sees people before God, true brothers, not to be competed with, but to be held to be bound to recognize God at work in creation. Not threats or barriers or competitors that need to be beaten. When David looks, he finds no comparison, no one-upmanship, no leveraging or angling, but relationship. So I think this passage ultimately sets before you a pretty startling question. Flannery O'Connor, a Christian novelist, says this from the South. She says, in a way only she can write it, "You have to make your vision apparent by shock. To the hard of hearing, you shout. And for the almost blind, you draw large and startling figures." It's a little bit of what I think is going on in this chapter. All of the grotesque bloodiness, the slapstick humor, the ridiculousness of the image that pursues is trying to make a point shockingly clear to you that too often we miss. When you compare yourself to the people around you, when you compete to get ahead, to feel ahead of them, when you compete to keep up, to get in on it, to find a place for yourself, you unknowingly take up a sword and join in on a violent game that has havoced this world since the murder of the first brothers. The comparison would turn its eyes away from what God is doing and fix its attention on a competition against one another. The whole game, always one way or another, becomes violent, soul-crushing, nothing that God is doing in salvation, restoring of identities. So be honest with yourself for a moment. Where do you find yourself making comparisons? I'm not asking you to publicly come up and begin to describe who it is you've been comparing yourself to and how you find yourself stacking up in those comparisons, but be honest enough to admit with yourself that we all do it. We live in a world that runs off of it. The comparison, the angling, where is it happening? I know you probably see that person and you say, oh, how are you? How are things going? Good, good. I'm so glad. God bless you. We'll be praying for you. The friendly smile of competition across the pool. It's all friendly. You know you don't really mean it. If you were really honest with yourself, you're not actually doing it for their benefit. It's a kind of sport, a game. And most of the time, it covers up the sword that's really in your heart. Be careful. That kind of competition has a way of destroying you and them both, destroying everything around you, finding yourself at the end of the competition and everyone laying dead. That's the warning of this passage. Last week, the Amalekite tried to manipulate the opportunity, to reposition all of the items he had found, the body of Saul, the crown, to work it in such a way that he might get a reward out of it, the news might be leveraged for his benefit. This week, we get two groups trying to compete their way above the other. They try to manipulate one another, manipulate the comparison, the competition, the victory, to try to earn the very same thing, control. The Amalekite worked his angles to get ahead. These men competed with one another to feel ahead. Death, violence, sacrilege always becomes the inheritance, the real end of both of those stories. Let me wrap up with this. The only way David is able to escape all of this is a willingness to trust that God's plan in the end doesn't require him to take it up, to carry it into the battlefield, to step into the arena and make the victory happen for himself. David believes by faith that as God always has been, God is continuing to work it out. He doesn't need David to run ahead to make it happen. What God really needs from David is a quiet and humble submission. Faith. Trust that God is doing something. It reminds me so much of Jesus. You know, Jesus was claiming a crown, came talking about being king, and it was a crown that he wasn't the only person competing for. Jesus came to earth, King of Kings, but Rome wasn't quite ready to hand over that title to some peasant walking around in Palestine. Rome saw itself the King of Kings. Herod was functioning as a king at the time, and he saw Jesus' claim as a threat to his influence, competition forming, one that needed to be dealt with quickly and swiftly. The Jewish elites weren't quite ready to give over the power that they had carved out. They might not have had ultimate power, but they had enough they weren't willing to start sharing it with Jesus. Jesus got killed because he was beginning to filter away to draw influence away from the people who most desperately wanted it. They saw Jesus as a comparison, a threat, a competitor, and they do what happens most in competitions. They moved as quickly and efficiently as possible to put an end to the competition. They saw Jesus as a threat, a competitor. They crushed the competition as quickly and efficiently as they possibly could. What did Jesus do? When it came to those moments of conflict, competition, Jesus does absolutely nothing. He stood before Pilate, wearing a mock crown, a mock purple robe. Pilate says to him, "The people are calling you King of the Jews. What do you have to say for yourself?" You can sense the comparison, the competition. Do you remember what Jesus says? Jesus says to Pilate, "I am what you say I am." Jesus won't compete. He won't take a stand for himself. He doesn't need to defend himself, to carve out his place in the competition. There's no defense. Jesus didn't need to compete for approval, not of Pilate, not of the crowds. He didn't need to rally the crowds to his defense in the moment. He basically says to Pilate, "You're the one with power. Whatever you say I am, I guess I am." He just put his life in Pilate's hands, knowing full well where it would lead, really rejecting the competition, refusing to play the game that everyone else around him was playing, a desperate grab for power. Jesus knew that his calling was simply to follow. So he did that. He followed wherever God would lead him. He hung on a cross, and as the soldiers sat beneath him, gambling over his clothes, the crowd spitting on him, he looked down on all of this competition, and he prayed, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." There's so much talk these days about peace, about curbing violence, about dealing with the competitiveness, the rage that we find in our culture. But the Bible suggests that there's really only one true way of dealing with it. We have to learn to die to ourselves, to let go of control, become a follower, to follow Christ and submit to what he is doing, to trust by faith that he is working out a plan that leads to good things, even when the evidence, the competition, the violence around us might lead us to believe, to defend ourselves, to fight for our piece of ground, to get what we can get while the opportunity is still in front of us. Instead, following Jesus teaches us to recognize a soul, not a competitor, within ourselves, within the people around us. To survive, we're told to compete, to play the game. But David introduces us to a new way of doing it, by faith. A faith that becomes real, ultimately, in what we see lived out by Christ. A willingness to give up the competition, to let go of the comparisons, to focus our attention on what God is doing, where he is leading, and what he is saying. How ironic that Jesus had taken off his crown, taken instead a crown of thorns, come to a crowd that mocked him and spit on him, left the throne of heaven to come down and play this role, not of king, but of a suffering servant. He lost his crown to hang as a criminal, so that you and I, when we follow him, when we do likewise and set aside these crowns, this life, we're given instead an eternal crown. As we saw in Revelation, the promise that we might rule and reign for all eternity with Christ. Not because we found a window of opportunity, not because we worked some advantage, not because we fought our way to the top of the pile, or crowned with that crown of achievement, but because we chose to give up the comparison here. Because we chose to live not for this competition, not for what we get here and now, but trusting that by dying to ourselves, by giving our life to him, we might receive a crown greater than any could be won or earned or competed for here on earth. If you find yourself competing, you're losing. That's the simplest way to say what this passage is trying to suggest. To compete is to lose. But if you're willing to forfeit, which is not always easy, which will always require giving your very life, if you're willing to forfeit the competition and simply hold open your hands and receive, the crown is ultimately yours. A crown which can't be lost, which can't be conquered, which can't be stolen or taken from you. But to the man who's willing to lose his life, the whole world and all eternity becomes his. Let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we come before you this morning and we realize in so many ways we find our hearts competing. We do it with our own brothers and sisters, our own best friends. We do it with our own spouses. We do it with people in the workplaces, people we pass by in cars on the highway, people we sit next to in restaurants. We look at everyone around us. We use each other to try to climb the ladder, to carve out something, to get something for ourselves. God, we see this story in 2 Samuel and we recognize the ridiculousness, the carnage, the violence. And we recognize this morning, we find in our own hearts that we're playing the same game. God, forgive us. Forgive us of the times we stand at these pools and look at one another smiling, calling it friendly, when in our hearts is hatred and bitterness, desperation and desire and competition. God, I want to be in David's camp. I want to be with him, honoring my enemies, praying and trusting that you're leading. Looking for what you're doing, offering my life in service to your salvation. Not in this desperate pursuit, this competition, this bloodthirsty, desperate claim for more for myself. God, put us in David's camp. Put us alongside you on the cross, losing this world and losing this life to gain, to show another way, to point out that we are more than just competitors, but we are souls, we are creation before you, that you are working a salvation by your Spirit that redeems us from this conflict, that gives us dignity back, that gives us personhood, not that's competed for, manipulated, that's offered to us by grace and faith that finds its meaning and its purpose and its identity in following you, God. We know that that will cost us, as it did David, as it did you, as it did so many before. That following you is not easy, that it doesn't always seem to pay, but we recognize through your word, through your testimony, and through your life that this is the hope. This is the joy. This is the only thing worth living for that's eternal, that brings hope, brings peace, that brings contentment. So God, this morning we worship as a way of saying we want this to be true of our hearts and lives, that we would offer them to you. that we would lay down our crowns, that we would give up our life, that we would let go of our desires and pursuits, and that we would hold fast to only what you lead us into, where you point us, what you send us after. There we go, nowhere else, God. We need your help. We know on our own, as we leave here, our hearts are not in it. Our hearts want their own way desperately. We need your Spirit to move this gospel into our hearts in such a way that it begins to purify us and change our desires. God, that we wouldn't find our identity in imitating around us, but God, the imitation of you, that our desires might be mimetic, that they might be created not by the world, not by the people around us, but in seeing your heart and seeing your passion and seeing your desire and your sacrifice, that that image might rework our own desires for you, God, for more of you, for more of your grace. So we worship you with that heart this morning, God. Show us your way. Give us the courage to follow it. It's in your name we pray. Amen.